Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think that the war on terror, the problem for me with the war on terror has always been that it's never really been defined. First of all, it's really a metaphor. It's not it's not reflecting anything in reality, because terror is an abstract noun, and to declare war on something as abstract as the concept of terror, and who defines terror? I mean, obviously, if we really had a war on terror, we would have a war on the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, whether it's in the Muslim world, in Asia, or in Europe, or America. Because I think the element of terror in modern warfare is the overriding element. I mean, people are terrorized. Iraqis have been terrorized by... I mean, I couldn't imagine what it would be like for soldiers to barge into my home with a country... the population of which is 50% is under the age of 15. So we're talking about half the people in that nation are children, basically. So, I just have a real problem with the terminology, first of all. I think there is a problem out there, but the problem is a two-sided problem. There's a problem in the resistance, which is essentially what Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations are. They're resistance movements, and they're resisting certain social situations, circumstances, and configurations that they're not happy with. And in the Muslim world, I think many of the Muslims unfortunately had some sympathies with the resistance, not necessarily with the actual methods that were being used, but with the idea simply of something has to change. Something has to change. So I think in really what for me the war on terror, the essential problem with the war on terror is that it's attempting to get rid of the bitter fruit without going to the root of the problem. And I think that's obvious, and it's been said many times in many different ways, but I think that is at the essence of it. There's sores that have been festering for decades now, and nothing's been done about them. And that's what I find really the most disheartening aspect of all of this, is that we tend to let these problems just fester until it gets to the point where it's almost insurmountable. And then we kind of attempt to do these band-aid maskings of hemorrhages on the social body.
We have ideologues, we have demagogues, but what has happened to our intelligentsia, who I think have been wiped out as part of this, you know, this whole process?
Right. Well, we call, in America, there's a whole category of people that would, I would say are scholars for dollars. They're the people that end up becoming party mouthpieces, intellectuals that work within dominant state structures and are... You know, they're basically not being as critical as they should be. And I think in the circumstances that we're in, you need brave people. You need people to come out. I mean, that's why I think like Vanunu, for instance. I mean, people are vilifying him on the one hand, and other people are recognizing, I think, an incredible display of courage. Because one of the fundamental crises in human history is this problem that Sophocles really gets to in Antigone, which is where does our authority ultimately rest? Does our allegiance is it in the end to our state, or is it to our conscience? And I think that philosophers and religious peoples and intellectuals throughout history have always said that it rests with the conscience of the individual, never with the aggregate of the state. And I think that's where we're just seeing a type of silence amongst a lot of these people, that they're worried about their careers. I mean, you know, there's so much investment now in career and in position and in rank and in place, and there's an immense amount of money to be made in keeping silent and playing the game. And so I think that in the end of the day, these people are selling out, and I really feel that there's something very despicable about that, both morally but also pragmatically, because I think in the end of the day, the harm that they're doing, not only for themselves but ultimately for the societies that they live in and their children and their children's children, is, I think, it's really something we can't even estimate.
Of course, this applies to journalists as well.
Well, journalists are at the front I mean, you know, one of the things, the fourth estate, right? I mean, the idea of the press, that any democratic government, and I would prefer to use the term Republican government, that has representatives that are supposed to be representing the people, that's always based on an informed populace. And the only way the population is informed is through a vigilant journalistic class. If the journalists are not vigilant about really telling the people what these issues, what's at stake here, what's really going on, the hurriedness with which journalists are constantly working under these ridiculous deadlines, the superficiality that goes into a lot of the journalistic production, the lack of depth, and also the betrayal to corporate interests are all things that I think are causing a real deterioration in our society.
In Britain, we have this ferment. It's been going on for some time, and religious fundamentalism is sort of the burning issue. I'm not so sure whether it's the real issue. How do you see religious fundamentalism, particularly in Britain, where Muslims believe they are being demonized, etc.? How should we react?
You know, to be fair, I have to admit that I really do think that Great Britain, by and large, has made incredible strides just in terms of attempting to overcome race issues and overcome the disenfranchisement. I really do believe that, and I think anybody that's old enough to remember what it was like, say, in the 50s or the 60s or even the 70s, they have to recognize that there has been some really deep and profound changes. But in reality, it's not enough. And so at the same time, we can't sit back and rest on the laurels of what has been accomplished and neglect the very fact that an immense amount of work still needs to be done. And I think that fundamentalism basically thrives in certain environments. It doesn't thrive in other environments. And one of the environments it thrives in is situations in which people are impoverished and disenfranchised, that they don't feel that they're part of the society. And one of the things that really interested me, I recently went to Scotland, and a lot of the young Asians that I met there, what struck me was that they were very proud to be Scottish. I mean, there was a certain, I could tell that there was a certain pride in the fact that they were Scottish. And what has, I've never seen that in the British Asian community. And I think that partly that has to do with the fact that Scotland has a tradition of resistance against Great Britain, and the Scots pride themselves in that fact, and many of the South Asians still bear the brunt of a colonial relationship that was anything but healthy for relations between South Asians and between British people. But I think it's partly due to the fact that I think the Scottish have probably in some way made them feel more welcome, made them feel more part of their society. And I think that that's what really has to happen. I think there's an immense, an immense burden on the shoulders of the British people collectively and as individuals. And that in no way detracts from the fact that I have been very, very outspoken to the Muslims, for instance. I mean, that's my concern here more than any other concern, because those are the people that ultimately I've been addressing. But And that is that the Muslims of this country also have to be, irrespective of how they're treated, irrespective of how the society looks at them, they have to still maintain adherence to principles that don't change under any circumstances. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, his behavior when he was oppressed in Mecca was exemplary. And he showed the same largesse when he ultimately had power and ascendancy over the very people that had oppressed him. And that's one of the things that Muslims are very proud of about him, the fact that he forgave them when he was given the upper hand. And I think that type of largesse has to be, that's a spiritual component that needs to be developed. I mean, one of the things that I find in the term, I mean, it's a problematic term, but in fundamentalism generally, is a lack of the spiritual component. I think that it's very much focused on certain human emotions like resentment, rage, hatred, and it's identifying the other as entirely other, And certainly Islam never does that. Islam always looks at the human community, that it's one community, Banu Adam. And this is how they're called in the Quran, An-Nas, humanity. And it only singles out the Muslims as a group of people that have chosen to believe something and are attempting to live by that.